Nick, before we talk about the fire, I want to back up a little bit. I'm sure you were at the Beverly Hills Club a lot or some.
Many, many times, yes, of course.
And it was my recollection that many of the entertainers that would be on your show or on Bob Braun's show or on Ruth Lyon's show were entertainers who were in town playing the Beverly Hills.
You bet. And the Lookout House. Those were major entertainment venues. When the big name people came, it was always over there at one of those major clubs. And Beverly Hills was the one that was the biggest of all and lasted longer than the others as well.
You were there many times. Just kind of describe what the Beverly Hills Club was like as a show place, as an attraction, as a place to both dine and to see a show in the cabaret room.
For us, it was very upscale, and it was renovated many times over the years, and it grew. And it had big showrooms where you could put, you know, 1,000, 1,100 people in the room. And then there would be another room that would be a little bit smaller. And it would also be a showroom and a dining room. And then there would be the bar. When you first came in, there was an entertainment space there as well, a very large bar. And all of it was very ornate, very attractive, and quite well handled as an entertainment venue. You were always made to feel very special. A hangover from the days when there were very high rollers, when it was a gambling hall as well. And not too long before the era in which we're describing it, in some parts of Beverly Hills, they still stored the wheels, the roulette wheels, and the gaming tables. Some of those were still in the basement.
So the biggest names, Sammy Davis Jr.
Frank Sinatra.
So the biggest names, if they were going to appear in the greater Cincinnati area back then, they were going to play a set or a weekend or a week at the Beverly Hills Club.
That's absolutely correct, and it would be much more likely to be there. The Lookout House lasted quite a long time before it ran out of money and ran out of customers, but it lasted quite some time as well, and that wasn't very far away from Beverly Hills as well.
So when these stars would appear on your show at either Channel 9 or Channel 12, did you go over there to see them perform while they were in town?
Often I did. That was generally the courtesy. But as far as Beverly Hills is concerned, I would be there much more often because I wouldn't just be there as a courtesy for those who were appearing on my show. Even after I started doing news and other things, I would be there to be master of ceremonies for some benefit event. And that would be in one or the other of the big rooms there. And I never recall ever being paid. They were always benefit events for the fire department or for the Police Benevolent Association or for some hospital. And there would always be something like that going on at Beverly Hills because that big events always occurred there.
But even if you weren't paid, to be there at that opulent place and to have a great meal and also to help out as the MC, I mean, that was a pretty good gig.
Oh, sure. You always wanted to be there. I don't ever remember eating there, actually. I don't ever remember having dinner. Even the times, of course, if I went over there to MC something, I would almost never eat. I'd be working, trying to figure out who I was supposed to introduce and what the event was about. I was always working if I was at Beverly Hills. My name is Nick Clooney. At the time of the Beverly Hills fire, I was the anchor of news on Channel 12 in Cincinnati, Ohio. This, as you know, happened on a weekend, so I was not anchoring on that Saturday evening. I was at home. And I first got a telephone call, and simultaneously there started across our television screen a crawl, that is to say, the information about what was happening over what I saw almost immediately, within a few seconds, was a shot of flames. I didn't understand the flames till I read the crawl, and it said, "Fire at Beverly Hills Supper Club." And then I was told that also by our weekend anchorman, Bill Crafton. I lived 40 miles away, and so I went immediately to the television station first, and then when I saw everything was going well there, I went directly to the site. The people who were on duty that night and were our reporters who were either there or nearby and ended up at the site, first of all, Howard Ayne, a fine reporter who was there doing some work on his specialties and went immediately to the site. Reporter Joanne Moore was there and also went to the site, and reporter Kyle Hill. All three of those reporters were, I believe they were the first three television reporters to arrive. We were the only television remote system to arrive on the scene. By the time others got there, they were blocked from getting to the scene. So as it happened, we were transmitting the only live pictures.
I know that that night, because I was watching TV at all places, Tom Brinkmiller's house, the TV critic for the
sure.
Empire, and 9 was there with their live system, and 12 was there, but 12 had a much better picture. And I always got the impression that 12 set up their truck to get a good transmission back to the station, whereas 9 maybe got closer to the fire, but they had
actually
a picture that was kicking in and out and kicking in and out. So the best quality picture was on WKRC Channel 12.
Here was the thing that happened that worked in our favor. I don't like to talk about this in a competitive sense. All I wanted to say was this: why we were able to get interesting and, I believe, very personal coverage was an accident. You're indeed right. We had a wonderful engineer whose name was Al Salt. This was the first night of our live television transmission of a live event. This was the very first night. That itself is a story which probably does not need telling at this point, but we got there, and then the problem was we could not transmit with our reporters up at the scene. One reporter, Howard Ain, got directly to the scene, but had no way to give audio. Our engineer, Al Salt, said, just take this HT, a handy talkie, take it up with you. And he did indeed. Howard took the handy talkie to the actual scene, and he began talking. He could only give you word pictures. It reminded me a great deal of the kind of thing that was done at Desert Storm, where those who were caught inside Baghdad could not transmit pictures, but could give audio of what was going on. Howard was giving audio while we had the closest and most direct and most continuous picture of the terrible scene of the flames, of what was going on at Beverly Hills. He went on to do that. He did that all evening, giving some marvelous, very often and very understandably, quite emotional live audio reports from the scene. He continued to do that throughout the evening. I got there quite late with our chief photographer, Ed Patton, marvelous fellow who had been there a long time. We could not get up close to the scene on the little driveway that went up the hill. So we went around the back of the hill and climbed up the very wild and almost inaccessible area. We climbed up there with Ed's film camera, very heavy. Ed had terrible asthma, but he climbed that hill anyway. And we got up there, and the only contribution I would have made at all was because of Ed. We got there, and when I went to the top of the hill, we had, of course, terrible scene there, the tablecloths under the people. It was something I don't want to ever see again. And in the meantime, we did run into the Southgate fire chief, whose name now escapes me, and we had an interview with him. And I believe we were the first television reporters to... I asked him why the sprinklers didn't work. And he told me, after a short pause, he said, there were no sprinklers. I said, well, surely that's... how can that be possible? And that's when I learned that in northern Kentucky, in that particular area, the sprinklers were not required. And that was our headline as the story was rolling down toward its climax. We then completed all of that. We went on for days thereafter. I must say that there were three really bad moments for me. One was when I went to the Fort Thomas Armory, which was the place where all of those who had died. This was much later in the evening, of course, or later in the morning, I should say, by circumstance that doesn't need elaboration. I went in there, and you don't see in your lifetime, it is not often that you'll see a scene where there's more than 100 people who have died all in one place, and that has stayed with me forever. There was another moment I talked to a firefighter. He was sitting down. exhausted. Most of the bodies that we knew about had been removed already, or were in the process of being removed. And he was sitting down, and he was, of course, his face was streaked with tears, and he had a piece of paper and a pencil, and he was apparently had been counting the dead. He didn't see me at all. He was just kind of babbling, and he said, "No, wait a minute. She was pregnant. There's no question about that. Now, is there one or two?" That was the first thing that really got to me. And then, odd thing, one had not yet been removed. And there was a tablecloth over this woman. You could just see her feet, that's all. And there were silver shoes and silver stockings, I remember. And I had to sit down for a minute then, and because I was thinking about how she had spent the early evening, and probably with great thoughts of what a wonderful evening it was going to be, and this is how it ended up. And that was the story to me that night. It went on to be, as you know, an enormous story. Even at that moment, when the roof collapsed, many in the Red Cross still believe there might be hundreds of victims still under that, and we were reporting that, as were all the others. Fortunately, that turned out to be an exaggerated fear, and so we got through that. But you don't end up reporting, thank God, you don't end up reporting stories like that much in your life unless you're a combat reporter in the midst of warfare. Most of the rest of us don't run into stories of this kind over that period of time, and they end up affecting you in one way or another for all the rest of your life. Let's put it that way. You'll remember that forever. It was an event that marked your life. For instance, in this way, I remember that the legislature in Kentucky was biennial, and there was not going to be a session in the next year. And we started to campaign, if we could, for a statewide law about sprinklers in public places. And it did take the full year to get it done. But fortunately, we talked about it much more often, perhaps, than many of our viewers wanted us to. But at the end of the day, we felt an obligation to make sure that we were some small part of making sure that that legislation was passed.
Nick, when you go to any kind of event that's in a crowded room or a crowded theater, do you find yourself looking at the exits?
You'll not be surprised at all of us. Certainly all reporters, I'm sure all public servants certainly do in much more of a way than they ever did before. I don't even remember if I paid all that much attention to the accommodations and certainly to the numbers of people, which aisles might be blocked. How many exits were there? Were any of them locked or chained? I had seen many chained in the years before and not thought much of it, and probably thought, well, they're just trying to make sure nobody sneaks in, you know. And I watched that carefully, and I have on more than one occasion talked to the proprietors wherever I was about some things that I was concerned about. I've got my notebooks, all the ones that we were supposed to tear up and throw away, remember?
Mm-hmm.
I would take some of them for certain periods of time. I would take them, since I always lived 45 miles from where I worked, I always felt safe about taking some home and holding on to them in case I wanted to write about it at some future date. I have, maybe 300 or 400 of my old notebooks, the ones from those days, and from the last days of May and the first days of June in 77, I have, and I don't have to look inside them anymore, because just looking at the outside, they're all waterlogged from that night particularly, and then the subsequent days when the network people were coming in as well.
Waterlogged because just the intense heat and the intense sweat?
Yes, exactly so. And in some cases, water. There would be dousing some early on, some flames. And then I think there was also a kind of a spray of water. I didn't think about it at the time. I don't know what that was. It was almost a mist of water around up on the hill before they chased us off again, which was quite the proper thing to do. I was looking at one just as you called. And here's how I think we felt about things. This is a note from Thursday, 9 June 77. Ann Deal from Shillitoe's called. Wants to do a book for local circulation concerning the fire. 5,000 copies, 8.5 by 11. Color photos, black and white photos. Need 30-page narrative. Wants me to write it. Won't do it. Won't do it. Can't do profit. Don't think they should do profit either. That's how we felt.
When you arrived up there, the fire started about 9. Do you have any sense of time? Was it midnight or was it before?
It was a little before midnight. I got there, and I remember my usual commuting time was about 45 minutes. It was a nasty little road, Kentucky 8. I made it in 38 minutes that night, and that was up at the television station. And then I got over to the other. Thank heaven the all the firefighters and all the police knew who I was, and they were nice enough to let me get close with my car and park it just about 50 feet from our live truck. And I saw Ed Patton. Ed Patton is a big, strapping African-American guy. He always looked like he meant business, and indeed he did. He was a wonderful shooter. And I said, I know you don't breathe so well, Ed. I was thinking of climbing up the back end of the hill up there. What do you think? I don't know if you've been around to the backside there before or since, but it was all scrub, just nasty and straight up and down, small trees and that kind of stuff. And, well, we pulled about several of those little trees getting up there, and Ed went every step of it carrying his 16-millimeter camera. And those things are heavy.
In the years since, there's been memorial services up there on Memorial Day weekend. Have you been to any of those?
Only two. I felt odd about them. They, as you remember, and I'm making no judgments here, believe me, anybody who was there was affected in one way or another, and people mourn in different ways. But I remember at first the star who was there that night, John Davidson, couldn't find it in himself to be there for them, you know. The people were wonderful in what they said and how they talked about it and how they talked to each other about it. But there was still a pall over it, you know. And I don't think any of us ever found quite the right sense of how to frame that. I think that probably took more perspective than most of us were able to pull up at that time. And so I stopped going. If they had something to contribute to, I'd do that. But I stopped going.
And when you drive 471 and you come by that Southgate exit, sure, and there's that big hill there, when you drive by it, what do you think?
What I think is, as you know, those are their commercial buildings there now. And I was thinking, could I possibly rent one of those out as a business? And the answer is no. I could not be there. I could not do that.
But the top of the hill is still pretty barren,
yes,
is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I went up there once with Howard Ayne. God bless him. Howard, that night, took me directly back to something that I didn't hear live at the time, but that is one of the most famous disaster narratives of all time. And that, of course, is the narrative of the Hindenburg going down and the man trying to describe it over humanity, you know. Well, Howard, at one point, lost it. Took my breath for a moment. He couldn't. He was there when the bodies were still being brought out of the fire, brought out of the building. He was there that soon afterwards, and he saw them more than most of the rest of us ever did. How many were there, and how chaotic the scene was, and he saw too many who had lost their lives.
So by the time you got there, you mentioned the morgue and going there later. By the time you got there, were there still, had most of the victims been moved to off the site?
Oh, yes. It was, there was almost some order to it. By then they had been moved from one place to, certainly from trying to get them, some of the firefighters pointed out, at least one of the doors that had been blocked by people who did crowd in and couldn't move. And the ones who were outside were trying to pull people out, you know, so that others could make it. And so I saw none of that. That was described to me by the men who were there at the time. And that had all been cleared. And as I pointed out, this one firefighter who had obviously been there all night, and he was I have no idea what his life has been like since then. And I must say that for those other heroes, you want to talk about heroes, all of us had interesting stories to tell. In our case, the footnote was that I had had a confrontation with one of the people who was in engineering and deciding how we would do our work and make our equipment as up-to-date as possible. And we had been advertising that we had a live truck out there, and we'd been advertising it for a week, and we didn't have the live truck. It wasn't working. So I had this confrontation with the fellow and said, I'm not going to say that we've got a live truck if we don't have a live truck. It's not going to come out of my mouth. So he said, well, the piece of the equipment we need to make it work is on budget, and you'll get it the 1st of June. That's when you'll get it. That's when you're supposed to get it. That's when the budget comes out. And we'll put it in, and it'll be on the street by the first week in June. And I went to the general manager, a great man named Bob Wiegand, and I said, look, Bob, we do news. We don't do advertising and promotion. We do news. And we're saying that we've got a live truck, and we don't have a live truck. And he said, what does it take? And I told him, and he called the chief engineer in, sent him over to a place called Western Electric, I think it was, and he picked it up, and they put it in the truck. And on Friday, he took the truck out, Al Salt did, God bless him, and went to Eden Park and tried it out, and went over to Northern Kentucky and tried it out, so that on that Saturday, from Friday to that Saturday, we would have a live truck, and we would be able to help report that story. So to us, these small footnotes have, of course, a great resonance.
I want to ask you one last question, because as a newsman, you covered the fire, you covered the aftermath, the aluminum wiring, everything. To this day, 40 years later, there's still some who think that the real story hasn't been told, that there was some conspiracy, that it was in some way arson.
I don't believe that at all. What I believe, however, is that that a crime was committed, in my view. Now, it was not to the point there was no one there, no owner, no person responsible for building it or anything, could ever be convicted on the evidence of what happened that I saw. But nonetheless, God knows, everybody was aware to the point that I just assumed that large enclosed space would at least be covered by sprinklers. And I truly believe that the concern was, at the most superficial level, that the concern was, well, those things go off every now and then when there's only just a false, and we lose thousands and thousands of dollars. I believe that might have gone in to the consideration of whether to put in the sprinklers or not, and that is a crime.
Nick, I can't thank you enough for your generosity with your time here today. Thank you very much, Nick.
You bet, John.